Chapter 6. The Globalizers. Birgitta Jonsdottir and I are driving away from Reykjavik on a highway that cuts through Iceland's starkly sculpted tundra. Nearly every other car on the road is headed in the opposite direction, and with good reason. Just the day before, the volcanic mountain Grímsvötn, at the center of Vatnajökull, a glacier in southeastern Iceland the size of Delaware, spontaneously ejected a 12-mile-high mushroom cloud of steam and ash into the sky. Now Jonsdottir's white Honda Jazz is pointed in the direction of the mass of aerosolized lava rock slowly expanding across the country. "The government put out a warning that you shouldn't drive this way," Jonsdottir says flatly from behind the wheel, her expression mostly hidden by large black sunglasses covered in glass crystals and framed by black hair cut into a severe fringe. She's wearing a black shirt, stockings with a blue and black paisley design, and white leather boots. "I don't care. We're going anyway." When we arrive in the town of Kvaraketha an hour later, the ash cloud has become a thick gray line with vague borders looming on the horizon. By early evening, it will have reached the town and blocked out the sun, imposing a biblical darkness that's especially unusual in late Icelandic May, where the sun typically sets at 11 p.m. and continues to illuminate the sky from behind the horizon for the entire night. With a few hours before the ash cloud hits, we drive through the small town where Jonsdottir lived in her teens, and she points out landmarks: the concrete house with a large garden that her grandparents built, the unassuming headquarters for the neo-Nazi party of Iceland next door, greenhouses heated with geothermal water and sulfurous hot springs that bubble up randomly around the suburban grid. "They're always changing," Jonsdottir says in her lilting and staccato English. "A few years ago, one opened up underneath the family's living room. Then we drive by an old schoolhouse, and Jonsdottir tells me one of her many stories of anti-authoritarian rebellion. In this building, she says, a teacher first cornered her and tried to sexually molest her, threatening to give the 14-year-old a low grade in his class unless she let him touch her breasts. She says she responded by threatening to hang him from his dick if he ever tried to touch me or any girl in the school again." She drives on, any emotion hidden behind her glasses. But she continues her tale. Over the next days, Jonsdottir tried to convince other victims who had been sexually bullied by the teacher to press charges or speak out against him. None would. She talked to school administrators, who she says ignored her story and asked her not to repeat it. A few minutes later in our tour of Kvaraketha, we pull up to an art gallery built into a greenhouse. This glass structure, Jonsdottir says, with a dark laugh, was the scene of her first direct action. In the middle of an art exhibition attended by the teacher who had tried to touch her, the punkishly clad teenager stood on a chair above the crowd and publicly denounced him, calling the man a pedophile and detailing his attempted sex abuses. "My grandparents weren't very happy about this," she says with a thin smile. Telling uncomfortable truths is a skill that's come in handy in 21st century Iceland, a fishing island turned banking paradise where a mountain of financial and political lies and half-truths have collapsed into a record-setting financial crater. Only in the angry revolution that followed that crisis could a punk, poet, anarchist, and all-around kicker of hornet's nests like Jonsdottir dream of coming to power as a politician. Since being elected to Iceland's parliament in 2009, Jonsdottir has sought to fill the Vatnajökull-sized void left by the country's banks with a new national identity: the Icelandic Modern Media Initiative. A series of bills that she and others are still propelling through the Icelandic legislature would turn the island into the world's strongest legal haven for leakers, whistleblowers, and digital truth-tellers of every variety. The inspiration for the initiative, known as IMI, was conceived in the same hacktivist's fits of imagination as WikiLeaks. Jonsdottir, Julian Assange, and other WikiLeaks volunteers crafted it side by side, and Jonsdottir worked with a secret-spilling group during its ascendancy to the international spotlight and its release of the Collateral murder video. But Jonsdottir sees IMI not as merely a stable foundation for the future of any single transparency outlet. She views it as the next step in a decentralized and global media movement, an Arctic anchor for whistleblowers and muckrakers everywhere. "I want WikiLeaks to morph into 2 things or 10, she told me when we first met in a Reykjavik cafe 6 months earlier. "The most important thing is to make it possible for others to do what they're doing. Once IMI is in place, they can all come here." IMI, in its ideal incarnation, would mean that the manifold WikiLeaks of the future wouldn't need to live outside the law and use uncanny technical expertise to stay ahead of their foes. Instead, she envisions a horde of leaking outlets and investigative journalists simply moving their servers and a skeleton staff to Iceland, just as companies incorporate in the Cayman Islands to escape the world's tax system, or Ayn Rand's men of the mind move to the mountains to escape corrupt government. A Scandinavian Galt's Gulch for the world's secret spillers. WikiLeaks was an important icebreaker, she says, her words accelerating. It was the tip. IMI is the rest of the wedge, and it will open up everything. In September 2010, just as WikiLeaks was ramping up its serial blitzkrieg of leaks, a German spokesperson for the group then known as Daniel Schmidt gave an interview with the magazine Der Spiegel. He told the Newsweekly that his real name was Daniel Domscheit-Berg and that he was leaving WikiLeaks after having been suspended by Julian Assange. His expulsion after 3 years of work, he said, was due to his having asked too many questions about Assange's focus on America-centric megaleaks and the group's growing dysfunction. "There are technical problems and no one to take care of them," he told the magazine. "We grew insanely fast in recent months, and we urgently need to become more professional and transparent in all areas. This development is being blocked internally. It is no longer clear even to me who is actually making decisions and who is answerable to them." He hinted at a new post-WikiLeaks project. "I will continue to do my part to ensure that the idea of a decentralized whistleblower platform stays afloat. I will work on that now. It's in line with one of our original shared convictions. In the end, there must be 1,000 WikiLeaks." In the year following that 1,000 WikiLeaks prophecy, copycats began to spring up by the dozens in all flavors and languages, editorial goals, and technological means. BaltaLeaks, BritaLeaks, BrusselsLeaks, CorporateLeaks, CrowdLeaks, EnviroLeaks, FrenchLeaks, GlobaLeaks, IndoLeaks, IrishLeaks, IsraeliLeaks, JumboLeaks, KHLeaks, LeakyMails, LocalLeaks, MapleLeaks, MurdochLeaks, OfficeLeaks, PornWikiLeaks, PinoyLeaks, PirateLeaks, QuebecLeaks, RueLeaks, ScienceLeaks, TradeLeaks, UniLeaks. Mainstream media outlets like The Wall Street Journal, Al Jazeera, and Sweden's public radio service set up their own experimental leak portals. Commander X, the leader within Anonymous, whom Aaron Barr had tried and failed to unmask, created HackerLeaks, a repository for material stolen by hackers. The leaking scene became so crowded that two environmentally focused sites, GreenLeaks.com and GreenLeaks.org, threatened legal action against each other over the rights to the name. As Nation blogger Greg Mitchell noted, only one thing was missing from this newborn leaking movement. Leaks. Around the time of Domscheit-Berg's departure from WikiLeaks, the site's submission system had disappeared. Assange would tell me in November that the group simply had too much material in its publishing backlog to accept new submissions. A half-truth that hid a much messier explanation. One that would only be revealed by Domscheit-Berg in later months. But even with WikiLeaks' conduit closed, the new players in the leaking game seem to be receiving virtually none of those displaced leaks. One reason: they had missed the lessons of WikiLeaks' anonymity protections. Many of the new sites made no mention of Tor and used only SSL encryption or PGP, which failed to hide the identity of the user visiting the site. In some cases, they offered no security measures or encryption at all. Even the mainstream media sites, despite coveting WikiLeaks' trove of documents, seem to have misunderstood its technical side. Al Jazeera's leak portal, which it called its transparency unit, only offered an SSL encrypted site with a PGP key and suggested users run Tor. It had no Tor hidden service, the safeguard that would have not only permitted but required users to be anonymous. It didn't offer cover traffic and even planted a tracking cookie file in the user's browser. The Wall Street Journal's leak conduit, called SafeHouse, was built so ineptly that the security community declared it dead on arrival. Jacob Applebaum, who had been supportive of other leaking copycats, pointed out that SafeHouse was vulnerable to an attack that would allow a network snoop to easily strip away the SSL encryption it used. And worse, the site wasn't compatible with Tor, despite suggesting that users run the anonymity program. Pro tip: if you're going to create a document leaking website, have a clue, Applebaum wrote. A legal analysis by the Electronic Frontier Foundation found that both the Al Jazeera and Wall Street Journal sites' fine print contained just as many holes. Both stated that if law enforcement asked for identifying information on the user, they could comply and hand over whatever data they might possess. The journal's site warned users it might share the leaker's information with any third party that served its interests. In other words, as EFF attorney Hani Fakhouri wrote in a blog post, they reserve the right to sell you out. With WikiLeaks submissions offline and no trustworthy alternative, the newborn leaking movement found itself in a drought, with one exception. In December 2010, BalkanLeaks, the document leaking site for a Bulgarian investigative journalism outfit called Beevil, came online with a slogan across its masthead: "The Balkans aren't keeping secrets anymore." When I checked out the site, I saw that it used a Tor hidden service for submissions, a rare sign of security smarts among the new crop of copycats. But otherwise, it resembled all the other obscure and leakless WikiLeaks wannabes from Brussels to Jakarta. Later that month, BalkanLeaks posted a Microsoft Word file with a note saying that the document had been submitted to the site's Tor server. It was an agreement from the Bulgarian Department of Energy outlining the construction of a nuclear power plant as a joint project of Russia and Bulgaria. Despite the importance of the agreement, the Word file seemed strangely to have been written by an employee of a private firm, but it showed no real evidence of corruption, and the agreement was even available on the Department of Energy's website. Hardly the world's juiciest leak. Just days later, another document appeared on the site, again obtained through Tor. This one was a letter from one prosecutor to another, including a list of 30 Bulgarian names, all the prosecutors and judges in the highest levels of the country's courts who were also Freemasons. "It is not illegal to be a Freemason," BalkanLeaks' note in Bulgarian posted with a document read. But does their oath to protect the public interest take precedence over their oath to the Brotherhood? Perhaps the chairman of the Ethics Commission, Tsani Sonef, who is a member of the Masonic Lodge, has an answer to this question. Bulgaria's contribution to the leaking movement was warming up. The next leak came shortly after, and it was a whopper: 100 pages of documents. They represented the full transcript of hours upon hours of wiretaps in a bribery case against Bulgaria's former Minister of Defense, a judge, and the former Secretary General of the Ministry of Public Finance. They contained frank discussions of how much every level of the judiciary demanded in bribes for various matters. So many hundreds of Bulgarian lev for this crime, so many thousands for this contract. This is the first publication of the full texts of these recordings, which are a true guide to the methodology of bribery in the judiciary, BalkanLeaks representatives wrote. The site had its first real scoop, and as dozens of other leaking sites launched over the next months only to produce nothing, the lone Bulgarian trickle of leaks kept flowing. A few months later, the site published a criminal complaint in Greek against a high-level Bulgarian prosecutor, Rosen Dimov. 9 years before his judicial appointment, it turned out, Dimov, his girlfriend, and two Greeks had been charged in Thessaloniki, though not convicted, with smuggling and money laundering. Then it offered up transcribed, suppressed testimony of a witness saying that he had been pressured by a prosecutor to change his opinion in a Sofia real estate case. Then a list of the partial names and identification numbers of 37 previously unexposed ex-members of the Darjavna Sigurnost, Bulgaria's brutal secret police during the country's communist era. Balkan leaks had arrived, a lone beacon of success in the leaking diaspora. So in the summer of 2011, I pay a visit to Atanas Chobanov, one of BalkanLeaks' founders. We meet in front of the roaring Fontaine Saint-Michel in Paris, where he's lived as an expatriate for the last 2 decades. Chobanov appears wearing a T-shirt promoting Beevil, the tiny news site that spawned BalkanLeaks, with its logo of a Bulgarian buffalo and its slogan in Cyrillic, "Horns Ahead." He's a smallish man with a shaved head, elfin ears, and a perpetual few days growth of salt and pepper stubble. And after we sit down at a cafe outside the Sorbonne University nearby, he flashes an impish smile. "We got just 2 leaks, and they're good ones," he says in an accent that has layers of French and Bulgarian. One of those documents is rather tame. A budget for the National Bulgarian Railways, showing that they're deeply in debt. The other is significantly more interesting. It's the full transcript of the trial of Angil Donchev, a Bulgarian prosecutor who was recently found guilty of blackmailing another prosecutor, threatening him with a corruption investigation and a raid by the dreaded anti-mafia police known as the Berets. The case was sealed in court, but the leak reveals the full 33 pages of transcribed phone taps. In those wiretaps, the blackmailed prosecutor mentions that he had a $1 million home and was taking in 10,000 euros a month, far more than a typical prosecutor makes. Chobanov believes the case was kept shut to avoid revelations about the plaintiff prosecutor as it revealed the crimes of the defendant. He points out that every prosecutor involved in the case is also shown in the transcript to be a Freemason. "Juicy stuff," says Chobanov, with a tilt of his head and a giggle. As usual, the two new submissions, like all but the few of BalkanLeaks' documents that came through postal mail, were submitted through BalkanLeaks' Tor Hidden Service. Chobanov attributes the leak site's rare success, in part, to that religious adherence to strong anonymity. Nothing is accepted through email, Facebook messages, or the chat protocol IRC. Tor is not friendly, says Chobanov. We wrote a detailed explanation of how to install it, how to connect, and so on. But it's something pedagogical. We have to teach people to use anonymity, force them to use it. He admits that the system's inflexibility has likely turned some leakers away. In the end, we chose less usability and more anonymity. And it worked. We got submissions. In the long run, it pays to have that confidence. We became trusted because we don't give away our sources, because we don't even know who they are. But BalkanLeaks' reputation comes from more than its technology. The site and its parent, Beevil.bg, have 2 public faces among the dozen or so people who work behind the scenes: Chobanov and another well-known Bulgarian journalist, Asen Yordanov. They make an odd pair. Chobanov is small, bald, and cheery, where Yordanov is bearish, grizzled, and wears a dour expression by default. But they have a rare attribute in common. Both have sterling journalistic records in a country where most of the media functions as a toothless state apparatus. "Reporters in Bulgaria are either scared or bought," says Chobanov. "Money and fear." In Bulgaria, Newspapers frequently have contracts with government agencies to run notices and advertising on their behalf, a revenue stream that fuels a culture of self-censorship, Chobanov explains. Many media owners have close ties to the government. According to Reporters Without Borders rankings, the country has the least freedom of the press of any in the European Union. And on the darker side of its carrot-and-stick system, journalists are periodically and horrifically attacked. In 2006, TV journalist Vasil Ivanov, who had investigated organized crime in the country, had his apartment ripped apart by a bomb. A writer who covered the mafia, Georgi Stoev, was fatally gunned down in central Sofia in 2008. Another, Olgunyan Stefanov, suffered a beating with hammers the same year that broke most of the bones in his body. No one was charged in any of the three cases. The tradition of journalistic intimidation goes back to the dark days of communist rule, when the Bulgarian dissident writer Georgi Markov, living then in London, was nicked with an umbrella tip carried by a spy posing as an antique salesman. The tip planted a pellet of the poison ricin in Markov's leg, and he died in a hospital 3 days later. Yordanov and Chobanov live on opposite sides of Europe. By remaining in Paris and stashing BalkanLeaks servers elsewhere in France, Chobanov and the site's hardware are protected from the government and mafia in his home country. Yordanov, who still lives in the eastern Bulgarian city of Burgas, has no such protection. Neither is immune from attacks. Chobanov's family house in southeastern Bulgaria was visited in 2010 by officials who claimed that it was built illegally, what Reporters Without Borders described in a report as a typical intimidation tactic, often followed by violence. And in 2008, Yordanov was nearly murdered in his hometown by a knife-wielding hitman. Like a government and mafia-sponsored security audit, what hasn't killed the pair has only proved their journalistic credentials, casting them as incorruptible in the eyes of leakers. And the enmity of Bulgaria's powers that be may have also helped them gain the trust of their most useful source of all, Julian Assange. Clay Shirky, a bald and brilliant new media professor at New York University, traces the concepts behind the Icelandic Modern Media Initiative to a time long before WikiLeaks, before science fiction novels like Cryptonomicon and Islands in the Net imagined havens for contraband data in Grenada, Singapore, or the fictional South Sea island of Kinakuta, before even the invention of the internet. He points instead to an agreement made at the end of World War II between the intelligence agencies in the United States, Great Britain, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. With the war winding down and an elaborate system of intelligence sharing set up, this English-speaking subset of the Allies considered the prospect of giving up the stream of useful data each was receiving from its partners, and instead decided to simply keep pooling that information in the post-war era. They called it the Yakuza Agreement, and according to a theory that Shirky laid out for the audience at the Personal Democracy Forum in January 2011, it allowed the intelligence services to do more than continue spying on the Germans and the Japanese. Because the Yakuza member organizations were legally prevented from intercepting the communications of their own citizens, they traded off. Canada would spy on Australia's citizens and share its data with the Australian Secret Intelligence Service, for instance, while Australia wiretapped the Canadian populace and handed over its data to Canada's Communications Security Establishment. In fact, the mutual domestic spying Shirky describes has never been reliably documented. But Shirky's analogy remains useful. Just as governments may have spied on each other's citizens for the last 60 years, citizens are now spying on each other's governments. What we're seeing is a pattern of transnational leaking, he told the conference. WikiLeaks is the first media outlet that is genuinely multi-homed. There is no one country's laws that govern how WikiLeaks operates. Just minutes before, Birgitta Jonsdottir had spoken to the same crowd via Skype. Unable to travel to the United States for fear that her association with WikiLeaks would tempt U.S. authorities to keep her for questioning in its unfolding investigation. In her virtual talk, She outlined her plan for the Icelandic Modern Media Initiative and how she had tasked 4 ministries of the Icelandic government with changing 13 laws to make Iceland the most liberated media nation in the world. Shirky followed Jónsdóttir by describing how the combination of that plan and WikiLeaks functions as the inverse of his Yakuza scenario, a globalization of citizen oversight. Pointing to the South African government's attempts to control and redact the local press, he suggested that the path of a future leak might be routed from Johannesburg to Reykjavik, through London, and back to Cape Town. Just as WikiLeaks detoured its whistleblowers' documents through Sweden and BalkanLeaks routed its submissions through France, perhaps the future of secret spilling lay in WikiLeaks and IMI's multinational leak laundering. This is an alternate way of leaking, that is, in at least its current instantiation, obviously superior to the point of view of the leaker to any previous system, he told the crowd. And then he ended with a prediction that this innovation in leaking across national boundaries would lead to leak suppression laws that crossed national boundaries too. There will be a massive push for globalization of control of secrets. I think we can expect an enormous amount of pressure to be brought to bear against the system we've just heard described, he warned. I think this will fail. But that is the struggle we're going to see today. Around the corner from a sunny square on Stockholm's Nytorget Street, where blonde youths wear straw hats, eat ice cream, and lounge on the grass, walls of craggy granite spring up and drop the sidewalk into the shadows. 100-foot rocky hill rises to a peak overlooking Vita Birjan Park, a large patch of green in Södermalm, the hip neighborhood where Lisbeth Salander lived in Stieg Larsson's Millennium Trilogy. At the summit perches a picturesque 19th-century stone cathedral. But, as in Larsson's novels, the darker, more interesting world lies beneath. Jan Kaulung, the gray-stubbled and blue-eyed founder of the internet service provider Banoff, leads me into a tunnel cut into the hill, past a pair of 20-inch-thick steel doors, and into the White Mountain Data Center, a digital bunker first built as a Cold War nuclear shelter and now converted into one of the world's most secure places to store information. We walk past 2 backup power generators originally designed for German submarines, a hydroponic garden, and a network operations center housed in the room that would have been used to run Sweden's civil defense in the event of a nuclear winter. In a cave full of servers cooled by roaring fans, a glass-walled conference room hangs above the racked computers, embedded in the ceiling rock with 13-foot steel bolts. Climbing up a set of stairs, through a tiny door that forces the tall Swede to stoop and bend, and past a wall of gallon-sized lead batteries, we arrive at our destination in a messy storage room. On a cluttered IKEA shelf sit the 2 elongated pizza box-shaped objects that Kaulung has brought me here to see, a pair of Dell servers. From the day of WikiLeaks' October 2010 Iraq War exposé through the first 7 months of its Cablegate release, these 2 machines ran the world's most controversial website. He picks up one and hefts it into my hands, admiring the computer with a boyish smile. I like to imagine it's the Ark in the first Indiana Jones movie, a box in a warehouse somewhere that contains all the world's secrets, he gushes. In fact, even now, a month after WikiLeaks ended its contract with Banoff, the data center's staff still hasn't erased the server's data. I'm thinking of putting them on eBay. A yoke, Kaulung adds. Banoff's granite walls, Kaulung assures me, are strong enough to protect its computers from even a nuclear blast. But that's not why WikiLeaks sought out the data center's pricey services, starting at $1,500 a month and steeply rising with power and bandwidth costs. Instead, he says, the underground fortress is a kind of metaphor. Since 1766, Sweden has had some of the world's strongest protection for journalistic sources and freedom of information, rooted in a constitution written before the United States' First Amendment. Under that constitution, censorship of the press is virtually impossible, and except in cases of national security or treason, Prosecutors are prevented from even asking a media organization for the identity of a confidential source. Despite its subterranean chambers and bulletproof doors, not even Banoff pushes the boundaries of those free speech laws quite as far as another company across the city in a bedroom-sized basement of a rundown building in a northwestern Stockholm neighborhood. Perry Kuito AB, also known as PRQ, has no hydroponic gardens or other James Bond villain accessories in its humble server room. But the company served as the central hub for WikiLeaks, including its submission system, long before it engaged the services of Banoff. In fact, since 2004, PRQ has assembled some of the web's most controversial and legally questionable denizens, and the company brags that it has never once taken down one of their sites. Before WikiLeaks, the most famous inhabitant of PRQ's racks was undoubtedly the Pirate Bay, the world's most popular source of pirated music and videos. Both PRQ and that iconic piracy site were founded by two Swedish hackers, Gottfried Svartholm and Fredrik Ney, a pair of neo-libertarian coding savants who were 19 and 25 years old at the time. The Pirate Bay draws more web visits than the New York Times, the Huffington Post, or Netflix, not simply by maintaining an enormous index of downloadable copyright-violating material, but also with entertaining antics like posting the legal threats it receives along with its own responses on its website. Once, the Swedes advised lawyers from Steven Spielberg's DreamWorks studio to please go sodomize yourself with retractable batons. On another occasion, they went so far as to suggest a specific model of baton to Apple's attorneys, the ASP 21-inch. In 2007, Ney, Svartholm, and a third owner, Peter Sundi, tried to raise enough donations from their users to purchase Sealand, an abandoned UK military platform in the North Sea that would serve as a home outside of any nation's copyright laws. Sealand refused to sell them. After Swedish police raided PRQ in 2007 and confiscated servers with the intention of taking the Pirate Bay offline, the file-sharing site left its original home to bounce among a variety of temporary hosts across Europe. But PRQ has kept plenty of other colorful customers. Kafkas Center, a Chechen rebel media site, was one of the first to take refuge in PRQ's basement in 2005. The site's users regularly post Islamist extremist rants about violent jihad against Russian, American, and Israeli infidels, along with uncensored news about the war-torn Caucasus. The Russian ambassador to Sweden demanded Kafkas be taken down in 2007. But when the Stockholm prosecutor had the server seized, PRQ immediately put up a backup server, fought the decision in court, and extracted $14,000 in damages from the government. PRQ also hosts Perugia Shock, an Italian blog that was banned from Google's blogger service for allegedly defaming the prosecutor of 2011's Amanda Knox murder trial. It even offers a home to pedophile.se and the website of the North American Man-Boy Love Association, web forums where users discuss sex with children but are restricted from posting images of child pornography. Even though I loathe what they say, I defend them, says Mikhail Vibori, a short, muscular lawyer who was recruited by Svartholm and Ney to become PRQ's chief executive. We don't cooperate with the authorities unless we absolutely have to. That absolutist anti-authoritarian policy means PRQ keeps no logs of traffic that could identify site visitors, as little information about its 2,000 customers as it can, and that it encrypts the small amount of identifying information that it does obtain. It requires sites to pay up front rather than ask for any personal details that would allow the company to extract payment later, and often receives those funds in envelopes without return addresses or handed over in briefcases of cash. Generally, we don't know who our customers are, and by Swedish law, we're not required to, Vibori says. These two Swedish data companies and the laws they exploit made WikiLeaks possible. But across the Scandinavian peninsula and the Norwegian Sea, through an unmarked door in a Reykjavik alley and up a flight of stairs, another hosting company may represent the PRQ and Banoff for Jonsdottir's next generation of media. When I ask 1984 web hosting founder Mordur Enjolfsson for some examples of his customers, he gives me a simple and defiant response. I won't answer that unless you get a court order. A 41-year-old Icelander rendered hairless by the genetic condition alopecia, Enjolfsson says he created the ironically named firm to prevent thought control. The company has become Iceland's largest web host, partly by maintaining an attitude in keeping with the island's Viking personalities. We don't respond to threats, intimidation, manipulation, pressure, or probes, says Enjolfsson. We will go bankrupt before we break the trust of our customers. One thing Enjolfsson won't do for his customers, however, is break the law. So instead, he's trying to change it, working as the treasurer for Jonsdottir's IMI movement. IMI is designed to not merely imitate the Swedish laws that brought WikiLeaks to PRQ, but to take them much further. It pulls together the best freedom of information laws from every country in the world, source protection from Sweden, safeguards on third-party communications from Belgium that prevent internet service providers from having their records subpoenaed, and New York State's prohibition on using foreign libel laws to bring local lawsuits, for instance. It revamps the Freedom of Information Act that allows citizens to requisition government documents and even introduces a Nobel-style prize for freedom of expression. Laws aside, Iceland already sports a few features of a perfect island data haven. The newly built Tor data center, for instance, on the outskirts of Reykjavik, pipes in cheap, green electricity from geothermal power plants, along with free Arctic air to cool the racks of computers. Its owners hope IMI will help expand the dozens of servers in the former aluminum plant to thousands, as controversial data from around the globe flocks to Iceland's protective borders. Cagey as always, Enjolfsson won't say where 1984's servers are housed, but he assures me they're mostly in Iceland, ready to benefit from Jonsdottir's initiative. If IMI can be passed, he says, it won't merely boost his business, but help to redeem Iceland from the shame and economic tragedy of the financial crisis that recently saddled every person in the country with the equivalent of $220,000 in debt. If we succeed, this will be the new cornerstone of the country's reputation, he says. In my humble opinion, IMI is the most important thing to happen to this godforsaken island since the Seas were written.